We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program writer and technically co-founder of The Intercept and author, amongst others at The Intercept, of The Assassination Complex, Jeremy Scahill. Welcome to the program. Jeremy, did I get that right? I mean, is co-founder of The Intercept correct? Oh, I'm sorry.
And the organization was started with me, Glenn Greenwald, and Laura Poitras. We were the three people that started it. So I guess we're technically the co-founders.
There you go. I don't know that I've ever seen that in print anywhere. And I just, there we go. Well, thanks so much for showing up, and we'll talk to you later.
that was all you wanted to interview me about.
That was the big thing I needed to get to the bottom of.
It's amazing. That's Sam. That's why you get paid the big bucks for this kind of probing investigative journalism.
Exactly. Exactly.
Next, you're going to figure out what kind of spice was in Donald Trump's taco bowl.
Believe me, I got a lot of guys working on that right now. Apparently, it's fantastic. All right, let's dig into this. The book is it's a compilation in addition to new information that you guys have been reporting on since 2014 at The Intercept. Let's just talk a little bit about the process of this, because in many respects, this book is the result of a fairly new phenomena. I mean, anonymous sources are not necessarily new, but the way in which you get this information and the implications going forward, I think, is pretty pretty important. Just tell us on what basis the reporting of this or a lot of the stuff in this book is from.
Well, we describe this in the book, and in fact, we published an essay by the source of the drone papers, who had worked on what the Obama administration calls the high value targeting campaign. You know, we call the assassination complex, and we can get into that about how, you know, Obama and every other president before him, you know, wants to be able to say that they don't assassinate people while actually assassinating them. But the individual who gave us these documents is a very brave person, given that the Obama administration is waging an unprecedented war against whistleblowers and slapping people in record numbers with charges of espionage, if people look at The Intercept at our website, one of our security people, Micah Lee, who was the one that taught Glenn Greenwald how to use encryption so that he could communicate with Edward Snowden, wrote an essay, "How to Leak to The Intercept," and one of the things that we began using, and now other news organizations are starting to do it, mm-hmm. Is a platform called SecureDrop, which basically allows people to anonymously transfer files that it can't be traced by any known surveillance device right now. Now, I'm not saying that's how we got these documents, but we do get a lot of documents through SecureDrop. But, you know, also there's a good old-fashioned just being there as a journalist and cultivating sources and not burning sources, and that's a way that more people come to you, is when they realize that you your word means something when you say you're going to protect them as a source.
So tell us the primary documents of the of this. What were they? And give us just the broad strokes of what they outline. I mean, we've obviously on this program we've talked about it. We talked to to Ryan Devereaux at the beginning of the series of stories, I think in 2014. But just give us a broad overview of what they show, and then we'll get into sort of the history of our assassinations in some ways.
Well, the Obama administration, as you and I are speaking right now, the Obama administration supposedly is preparing to release their official statistics on how many people have been killed in drone strikes outside of the declared war zones of Iraq and Afghanistan, including the number of civilians that have been killed. And, of course, it's going to be a minuscule number that they're going to put out. And so what we tried to do with this reporting project was to put in a digestible format, secret and top secret classified documents that are the military's own assessment of the impact of the drone program on their wars, both the sort of positives and negatives. And so the slides that we published in this book, and many of them we had published as part of our reporting paper, our reporting project, the drone papers, what they show is that the Obama administration has embraced a mathematical formula for determining civilian deaths that will almost always result in the number zero. When the question is how many civilians were killed, one of the documents that we have shows that 90% of the people killed in mostly drone strikes, but there were a couple of non-drone strikes by the Joint Special Operations Command, 9 out of the 10 people were not the intended target of the strike. And that doesn't mean that 9 out of 10 people were innocent civilians. It means they don't know who they're killing. And what they do is they label everyone killed an enemy killed in action, EKIA. And the only way you do not have that designation is if someone posthumously proves that you weren't a, quote, suspected militant or terrorist. And so, you know, I think that these documents really will serve as a stark pushback on Obama's portrayal of drone war as somehow cleaner and the claims that the number of civilians killed is minimal, because they don't know who they're killing in these strikes.
Is that Haymaker? Is that Operation Haymaker when you talk about the 9 out of 10?
So Operation Haymaker, which you had asked me for the broad overview. So Operation Haymaker in Afghanistan was a study of a year-long special operations high-value targeting campaign, and what it revealed was that you know, far from just sort of bumping terrorists off left and right, the most elite commandos in the U.S. arsenal were pulled into sort of timber wars and you know, tribal disputes in Afghanistan, and they did a study of one 5-month period of like who was being killed, and that's where they determined that 9 of the 10 people were not the intended target. And what's interesting about that is that was in Afghanistan, where the U.S. does have military bases, where the U.S. does have on the ground assets and an ability to gather intelligence. And if the numbers are that bad in Afghanistan, where they have tremendous ground assets, God only knows what it is in like Somalia or Yemen, where they don't have any bases.
Right. Let's address that. I mean, that notion of this is where there's the supposed absence of the tyranny of distance. Is that what it's they referred to it?
It's interesting because I'm sure that what Paul Revere, you know, and others were talking about when they were sort of opposing tyranny was the distance between a base and killing someone with a drone. That's tyrannical. The fact that they have to, but you know, it's because corporations help them. You know, do these documents. I mean, the IBM company, corporation.
All right, hold on. Let me stop you here for 1 second before we get to that, because tell us specifically what these documents are. They are a presentation to the Army about the efficacy of what of JSOC is doing.
Well, not exactly. These documents were produced by an intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance task force that was created under the Bush administration, with the explicit goal of sort of trying to convince Congress to give more resources to the hunter killer squads. And it was run at the time of the study, it was run by a guy named Michael Vickers, who is a kind of legendary paramilitary figure in U.S. history. And what the documents are is can I swear on the show?
Yes.
One senior special operations officer told us that these are a bitch brief. That's what he called it, meaning that the military is saying, you know, we need more resources. Why does the CIA not have to worry about how many civilians that they killed? You know, we need more drones. We need the ability to have greater latitude to strike targets on less solid information, because of the pressures you're putting on us to, you know, kill all of these terrorists around the world. We need X, Y, and Z resources. And so what they're doing is they're basically laying out what they see as their challenges, you know, in terms of prosecuting this assassination campaign, but really the point of it is to try to get more resources, better toys, more drones, more sophisticated drones. And in the process of their sort of lobbying campaign, they reveal a tremendous amount of information about how the actual drone program works. For instance, the kill chain, which is how the United States ends up with the president signing the death warrant of these people in a secret process. The military was putting that together in this slide to sort of complain that there's too much bureaucracy. But we look at it and we say, wow, Hillary Clinton was directly involved with like approving every single person who was killed in who was the target of a drone strike. That's pretty incredible. So there's a lot of interesting information that I don't think the military believed it was going to ever be in the public domain. But because a whistleblower came forward with it, you know, it is now public, and it is a pretty powerful pushback against the way that the drone program has been portrayed.
And so the people understand and are able to contextualize this. This is like almost like the functional equivalent of a startup business going out and looking for new VC capital, right? And here's our PowerPoint. Here's our presentation. This is why you should give us more resources. And this is going to be our return on investment. And we're going to be able to do this more effectively. So this is sort of like, they're not presenting. This is like, you know, sort of the rosy side of this too, right? I mean, and they're also obviously looking for a lot less scrutiny than one would imagine, because this stuff about, just go through the whole thing about the difference between a touchdown, because you can have basically, This is sort of like heads we win, tails you lose type of situation, because we can only get like, it's either a touchdown or a success, basically.
Right. So the terms that they use to describe, you know, their successes and their operations, Each drone strike, unless it's a what's called a signature strike, and you and I have talked about this before, where there's groups of people killed whose identities are not necessarily known, but the military or CIA have been authorized to kill them because their behavior, their metadata, their networks, intelligence analysts have determined means that they probably are terrorists. So that's one kind of drone strike, and that's not the most frequent one. The most common drone strike is called a personality strike, where it's one target per strike. And so when the military or the CIA set out to kill someone, it is one person per mission. Now, that doesn't mean they only kill that one person. They kill a lot of people, but it's just one objective. So when they then go out to do that, if they kill the person and they confirm that it was them, they call that a jackpot. But if they blow up the phone of the person, which they've used to track them, then they call it a touchdown until they confirm that it's a jackpot. It's like sports analogies. There's three sort of themes that you see when you start studying military terminology. One is they love to use Native American words to describe, you know, their most vicious weapons, you know, the Tomahawk cruise missile, the Apache helicopter. They also are very much obsessed with like merchants of death. So it's the Predator drone, the Reaper drone, but then also sports analogies and sports terminology, like the touchdown, or in the case of a jackpot, maybe gambling also.
Well, I guess my other point was that either they get, it's either a jackpot, assuming that they just don't take out the phone, and in that situation, it means like, you know, somebody could have gotten a hold of somebody else's phone. They've put, you know, their SIM card in a different, in somebody else's phone. But if they don't get a jackpot, they still don't lose, do they? Because they get an EKIA. Explain that dynamic.
Right.
So they can never, I mean, this is what you're talking about. It's not just mathematics in this situation. It's designations, right? Like there is no losing,
Exactly. They basically assume, and this is the official policy, They assume that everyone they've killed is an actual enemy, and that enemy was killed in action. I mean, the most famous EKIA was Osama bin Laden, where they radioed back in and they said, you know, Geronimo EKIA. And so I think, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, if the military is saying it's an enemy, you're imagining like a firefight or something, and we've killed 10 of the enemy. No. They really don't know who the people are, but they immediately label them enemies killed in action. And that's the, how the majority of people killed in drone strikes, that remains their designation forever, that they were just tallied in the enemies category, not in the we don't know or, wow, these were civilians category.
How would, I mean, the only way that you cannot be an enemy killed in action, regardless of who you are.
A child or a woman.
Yeah. And so how would, and how would that be established after the fact? I mean, obviously, I mean, honestly, like,
No, I know.
It seems ridiculous, and this is all sort of like catch 22 stuff in some ways. But
that's what I'm saying. They've created. I mean, it's sort of you know, it's quite brilliant because they've created a way of tallying civilian deaths that will almost always result in the number zero when asked how many civilians were killed. And because if you, you know, the way that you would, prior to, you know, a strike, the way you would see if it was a woman or child was if they have HD video cameras on the drones and you could actually see it and there's video of it that's been recorded and they show, oh my God, we killed, you know, women and children. But in the aftermath, the only way that you would ever have to be, you know, sort of acknowledge that you killed civilians is if survivors came forward or journalists traveled to the scene and reported on it or human rights organizations or whistleblowers who say, you know, look what we did. Like Chelsea Manning when she leaked the collateral murder video showing helicopter gunships gunning down civilians and journalists in Iraq, you know, that was proof that these people were indeed civilians.
Does the U.S. government do anything in a proactive manner to determine whether or not the, I mean, because as it stands now, the default is if you're dead, you were necessarily an enemy killed in action unless we have, you know, some type of other evidence that we're going to acknowledge, sort of, I guess, passive knowledge that you were a woman or a child. Is there anything proactive that the U.S. government does after the fact to do, to determine that their designation of an enemy killed in action is legitimate?
You know, I mean, we've asked the White House repeatedly for many years that very question, and you know what the official position is, which they'll email. If you wrote them, they would email this exact thing to you. They basically say that we take, you know, reports of civilian deaths very seriously. At any time there is a credible report suggesting that civilians were killed, we do a review of the incident. And so we asked them, can you make public any of these reviews? Like I was specifically asking when they killed Awlaki's kid, the 16-year-old son of Anwar al-Awlaki. And they said, oh, no, we can't make any of that public. So we don't actually know what that process looks like. And, they've killed seven American citizens that we know of in drone strikes, but they claim that only one was the actual target. And you know, when they killed Warren Weinstein, who was a USAID guy, and these two other people, then they sort of had to address that issue. But if they kill brown people, you know, if they kill like an Arab, a Muslim somewhere, there's not going to be any major scandal over that, and they know that.
I want to ask you about Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, who is the son of Anwar al-Awlaki. The story that I have heard is that, and I guess primarily probably through reporting, you know, the Intercept in some form or another, or people who yourself and Greenwald, is that he had left his grandparents' house to look for his father. He had gone to the region that his father was reportedly in. He was 2 weeks after his father's death. He was at a cafe with cousins of his in a public cafe when the strike happened. I interviewed a guest a couple of weeks ago who told me that he reportedly had a weapon and had on him, and that he was reportedly involved in some terrorist activity. Have you ever heard that reported anywhere?
Wait, who was the guest?
It was Malcolm Nance.
I mean, I know Malcolm, but Malcolm doesn't know what he's talking about with that. I mean, first of all, everyone in Yemen has a weapon. What does that mean? You know, I mean, like literally, I have gone through like checkpoints at rallies in Yemen where everyone's wearing these huge daggers. And they frisk you to go past it, but they don't care that you have a huge dagger there. You know, people walk around the streets with AK-47s, but no, Abdulrahman Awlaki was not in possession of a weapon. And even if he was, so what? I mean, this is like what is the point of that? But the idea that he was connected to terrorism, I mean, is completely false. What I think is true, though, and what's funny for me about this is that I actually like and know and respect Malcolm a lot, but I don't know where – I would ask him where he's getting that information.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things where I was just like, maybe there's been new reporting that I haven't heard
because I have
never read even that assertion. I mean, to the extent that I'm aware of it, the only thing I've ever heard is that I can't remember which one of the Obama administration advisors said, well, his dad was a really bad guy.
Yeah, that was Robert Gibbs. Let me address that, though. You know, I think that what I mean, obviously, if this kid was looking for his dad and he thought that his dad was, you know, sort of working with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, he would have been calling people. He would have been texting people.
Of course.
He would have been trying to meet with people. So, you know, I think that because of the way that they track people with metadata, you know, it's possible that they had determined that whoever was in possession of that phone that was calling all of these people must have been a terrorist. Now, that would probably be the most generous interpretation of why the kid got killed. But, I mean, the idea that he or the allegation that he was involved with terrorism is just ludicrous and false. I mean, I was Facebook friends with him. I know I spoke to his friends, his family. It's just not true. And it's really, you know, this is what they tried to do initially when he was killed. The CIA or someone in the intelligence community leaked that he was 21 years old, which was false. He had just turned 16. Family produced his birth certificate from Colorado. They portrayed him sort of as a mixture of a hapless tourist who had somehow just appeared in Yemen and a terrorist sympathizer. And all of this they had to walk back later. So, you know, why he was killed, we don't know. I mean, we've asked repeatedly for the White House to declassify their review of his death,
but
they haven't done it.
The idea that they would have simply targeted his phone, for instance, is sort of a perfect example of what is problematic about something like this, isn't it? Is that you can be not involved with terrorists and still call people who might be, and that in and of itself is not really, I think, at least morally, and I want to talk about the sort of the legality of this, but morally is not a legitimate reason to kill somebody.
Right. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying that I know that is what happened in that case. I'm saying that is a very solid possibility that, you know, there were a number of people that he was with who maybe had information or had been in possession of information about his father, his father's whereabouts, etc. And so when they then start putting into their system all of the different SIM cards and other selectors, identifiers, and they realize, oh, here's six people sitting together in this same place, all of whom have been in contact with this person, and this person from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they're military-aged males, they may say, well, it's safe to assume these are terrorists and we're going to take them out. I don't know that that's what happened, but I think that's one of the most likely scenarios. I think it's more likely than, oh, let's kill a teenager because he's Awlaki's kid. We don't know. But it'd be amazing if the Obama administration would actually be the most transparent administration in history and just tell the truth on this stuff.
All right. So let's talk about the history and the evolution of this, because in some respects, I mean, this is the role of the U.S. in terms of assassinations we've always been doing this, but the Obama administration has what they've done, you know, and I think Charlie Savage has written on this pretty well, it seems to me, has institutionalized this in a way, but it's fascinating how we got to this point. Just talk a little bit about when the first sort of, I guess, public, I don't know, I wouldn't call it a law, the guideline that we shouldn't assassinate people started with Ford, right?
Well, so you remember that in the 1950s when the CIA, you know, first hit the scene in an official capacity, you know, on the global scene, there was this series of coups and political assassinations, the overthrow of Jacob Arbenz in Guatemala, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. Then the you had the funding of death squads and juntas and et cetera. And then you had inside the United States, there were also these this spate of assassinations of political figures, the Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and on and on and on. And Congress began then investigating political assassinations, primarily focused on the sort of international activities of the Central Intelligence Agency. And what happened as a result of those hearings is that Gerald Ford, when he was president, needed to do something to sort of placate Congress. And instead of actually, sponsoring a bill that could be signed into law, Ford implemented an executive order that said that the United States does not engage in political assassination. And remember, Cheney and Rumsfeld were two of the most important people in the Ford White House. Rumsfeld he was the youngest defense secretary and the oldest defense secretary in U.S. history. But he was, these guys were obsessed with the unitary executive, with the idea that that the executive branch of government is a dictatorship when it comes to setting national security policy, and that Congress only has a role of funding it, and the Supreme Court only has a role of staying out of it. So the executive order allowed them to say, oh, well, we don't assassinate people, but it also was not a law. And every president since Ford, including Obama, has upheld some version of that executive order. Carter amended it and took out the word political and just had it say we don't engage in assassination. Carter also added, and agents and representatives of the United States can't do it either. But Congress has – it's not just that Congress never really thought, oh, well, maybe we should do this. They've actually avoided in an intentional way ever defining the term assassination or – translating that executive order into law, because then they would have to actually define what assassination is and examine, when Reagan tried to kill Gaddafi in 86, if it wasn't an assassination, what was it? When Bill Clinton tried to kill Saddam Hussein, what was it, if it's not assassination? And then all of these drone strikes. So, we basically live in an environment with this stuff where, the constitutional law professor Obama is part of the exact same cover-up of, and it's a public cover-up, though, of the fact that the United States does assassinate people, but has they've figured out different terms to use to sort of, misdirect, basically. Ooh, look at this shiny object over here, And right. That's what they've been doing for quite some time.
So people need to understand that for all intents and purposes, and probably this was also the motivation, by making an executive order as opposed to forcing Congress to make this statutory, in some ways what Ford was doing was just simply short-circuiting the process, because if the executive can make the order, the executive can certainly break the order and doesn't necessarily under no obligation really. I think statutorily, and this stuff is stuff where you get into that murky area of none of this has been adjudicated. There's no real law in this arena where once they make it the executive order, they can certainly, somebody at the OLC of the Department of Justice can write a memo saying when you issue an executive order, you don't have to publicly say that you've rescinded it or, exempted yourself at certain times from it. Because it's
right. That actually is what's happened with various executive orders, over time. What's interesting is that when Clinton was in office, Richard Clark at the end of his time in office was the counterterrorism czar, and Clark, said that that the lawyers in the Clinton administration were so concerned that if they did in fact, intentionally kill Osama bin Laden, that it would be a violation of the executive order, and they were concerned about the personnel that carried out those that assassination of being hauled in front of a court somewhere because of a violation of international law. Now in the post 9/11 world, none of that, nobody thinks about the international law or anything. But just interesting to note that Clinton's lawyers really were concerned that they were going to be in violation of a law if they killed Osama bin Laden, and you compare that to now when it's just taken as a legitimate part of our society that we just bump people off around the world whenever we want, wherever we want. You know, it's a pretty huge leap from a time when lawyers would be like, well, maybe we shouldn't do this.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that, because, you know, the foreword of the book is written by Edward Snowden, and he talks about the importance of whistleblowers. And I feel like, you know, and just the entire project of making the public aware about this. I mean, I know that from the perspective of a journalist, and that it really is not prominent in your calculation, or shouldn't be, or you believe that it shouldn't be. But the public doesn't seem to be terribly, broadly speaking, to be terribly upset about this stuff.
No, not at all. I mean, it's we've been groomed to sort of just accept that this stuff is necessary to keep us safe. And, you know, Obama really has elevated the support of liberals for these kinds of policies throughout his two terms in office. I mean, it's going to be one of the most enduring legacies of his presidency, is that he taught liberals how to love Dick Cheney's policies, or Dick Cheney's ideas. And you know, I think we'll look back later and say, wow, how did we let all of this get so far? But I think most people have, you know, most liberals sort of have felt like, you know, it's on autopilot now because Obama's handling it. And, you know, I just wonder how many of them would like to hear the phrase, or would be comfortable with the phrase, President Trump's kill list.
Right.
Because I don't think they would be. But it's not just about that. I mean, I do think that there's a huge partisan component to the support for all of this stuff. But also, it's just that we're, you know, we've now been in a permanent state of sort of having the U.S. at war everywhere around the world. I think a lot of people are just sick of it. But also, they're struggling. I mean, the working people in this country, poor people in this country, most people don't have time to pay attention to this stuff. They're trying to keep their families afloat, you know. I think it's a combination of factors. But it's not just the secrecy. It's also that people are beaten down from sort of being in this state of war for so long.
To what extent do you think that the calculation is, you know, at least we're not engaging in this is, I think, a segue into sort of the question of the efficacy of this. And the obvious answer to the question of, like, would you rather a ground war where, you know, hundreds of thousands of innocents are killed? Is why do we have to have, why is it just a binary choice? But between, you know.
That's like me saying to you, right, I mean, but that's like me saying to you, Sam, would you like a cookie or do you want me to hammer your head? I mean, it's just like, it's not one or the other. I mean, it's like crazy. They don't have anything to do with one another. But also, the U.S. Obama does have troops on the ground. He did surge in Afghanistan. He did engage in the exact kind of policy. I mean, so it's not even true. And you look now in Syria and Iraq, they have an expanding number of special operations forces. Having 250 special ops guys, that's like having several thousand conventional soldiers in terms of the money, the expertise, the lethality, all of that stuff. I mean, they are doing that. I mean, it's not even a fair question. It's trickery. It's not real. When they say, well, what do you want? Ground troops? No, that's not what you would be doing if you weren't doing drones.
Well, I mean, so what do you think? I mean, you know, I know that you at one point were contacted by Michael Flynn. Tell us about him and tell us about his assessment of these drone wars in terms of the efficacy and relative to what the stated goal is. I mean, that's the thing that you start getting into, like, what's going on here if there isn't sort of widespread belief that this is effective.
Right. And also, Sam, because I'm tethered to a landline right now where I'm speaking to you, and I'm going to be late for my plane if I don't leave in a few, minutes.
Sorry.
But let me answer your question. So Flynn was sort of a legendary figure. He was the chief of intelligence for the Joint Special Operations Command when General Stanley McChrystal was running it. And that's really when the sort of, you know, leash was destroyed for these guys, and they were able to run wild around, you know, the world, bumping people off. But you know, Flynn is a very sort of hawkish advocate for special operations warfare. But what he said when we interviewed him was that You know, the drone program is counterintuitive to our goal of trying to defeat terrorism, because we don't interrogate anybody anymore. We don't capture them on the battlefield. And so what his argument is not a moral one that we're going to create blowback, although he does acknowledge that. It's more that he's saying, you know, he's accusing Obama of killing people to avoid having to stick them somewhere, like Guantanamo or a secret prison or, you know, anything else. And I think that you have this bizarre moment where Code Pink and General Flynn somehow have reached the same conclusion on the drone wars, but for very different reasons. And I think that, you know, when people are saying, oh, well, the military would never obey Trump's orders to torture and do all of this stuff, that is so naive and short-sighted for people to believe that. Of course there are significant chunks of the military that are Christian supremacist radicals and people that want the torture brought back. They love Guantanamo. They want the secret prisons back. And so there's a political dynamic to this where they're sort of, you know, saying the truth about certain aspects of Obama's policies, but for their own reasons. And so the public sort of is the beneficiary of this, of these like internal wars, because some of the truth actually seeps out.
All right. Well, Jeremy, I'll let you go so that you can catch a plane, but maybe we can catch up with you, because I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of this being sort of embedded and sort of basically a deep state issue for our government in many respects, because from Bernie Sanders, like you say, through Donald Trump, and of course through Hillary Clinton. There doesn't seem to be, even Gary Johnson at one point in the last time he ran, nobody seems to have a problem with this as a policy, at least as it exists now. And
Look, man, I'm back in town next week. Back in New York. We should catch up and talk about the elections in the context of this.
All right, let's do that. Jeremy Scahill,
all right, awesome.
Thanks so much. We will link to the assassination complex. Really appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
Bye bye.